opening words this morning were written by Kalidasa, a 4th to 5th century Sanskrit writer. Look to this day, for it is life, the very life of life. In its brief course is all that is true and real, the bliss of growth, the glory of action, the splendor of beauty. For yesterday is but a dream, and tomorrow is only a vision. But today, well lived, makes every yesterday a dream of happiness, and every tomorrow a vision of hope. Look well, therefore, to this day. Rejoice and be glad in it. And now we will sing opening hymn 113, Where is Our Holy Church? And please remain standing for the recitation of the covenant. Love is the spirit of this church, and service its law. This is our covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another. You may be seated. Our words of reflection today will be followed by a moment of silence, and then I will bring the gong, and then we will do our meditation hymn after that. These words were written by Atharvaveda. Let there be peace in the sky and in the atmosphere, peace in the plant world and in the forests. Let the cosmic powers be peaceful. Let Brahma be peaceful. Let there be undiluted and fulfilling peace everywhere. And now Rob will come forward for his message.
Good morning. I'm Rob Palmay, and I've got the microphone today. I'm going to be going into some history at my age. I am history, but so it's easy for me. We are Unitarian Universalists, and this is a merging of two faiths or religions. It's not always been that way, and I'm going to take you back some of my memories and some history before, when we were two separate faiths and had two separate agendas. I have the title 1840. Though I like to study history, I'm just terrible about names and dates, and I sort of separate things by decades. And so I just started looking up around 1840, give or take 100 years. So 1840 was not a special year, but it fell at a time when the Unitarian Church and the Universalists were becoming significant factors in the new American society and culture. A significant date in 1838 was the last successful prosecution for blasphemy. And after that occurred, the Unitarians became, who they had to watch their step before that, became more free to express their views. So when I first, in my lifetime, the Unitarians and Universalists united as one church in the 1960s. My early experience was separately as a Unitarian and a Universalist. And to sort of let you know where I'm coming from, these were my early experiences. 1948, I was in an Episcopal church which was preparing me for confirmation or First Communion. I had learned by rote and would have to quote the Nicene Creed. I believe in the Son of God, etc. I did not believe in it. To avoid perjury, my lawyer father, a member of this congregation at one time, found and enrolled us in All Souls Unitarian Church in New York City. My mother had been raised in a Calvinist faith and had some doubts about all that. My father dropped us off at the church, and as we waited for him, my mother observed the numbers of parishioners being delivered from their limousines. I was in awe of the Rolls Royces. My Calvinist mother was impressed that the church was attended by so many of the preordained. A right place to be with the right people. A few years later, I went to Tufts College, Medford, Massachusetts. One Saturday night bull session, the subject of religion came up. A couple of the guys said they were Universalists, and I said I was a Unitarian. One of those Boston snobs, eh? That was the response. The Universalists had hopes for me. They have hopes for everybody. And worked me over for the next few sessions. They themselves were preparing for pulpits in the Congregationalist churches. Universalist churches were very rare in that area. God does not lavish great wealth on those who do not believe in hell. My friends were Sunday night Universalists and Sunday morning Congregationalists. Shifty bunch. They made me aware of a lot of social problems I had not known about. So as I go back in time, I see Unitarians and Universalists as having different agendas. Leading up to the 1840s, this was a new nation which questioned many of the customs and practices of the old world. One of our basic ideas was that all men were equal. We knew that was not so, but probably should be so. The idea was first disclosed by a Saxon jurist in the Swedish court around 1694. His concept was that in the law, all men are equal. He also advocating applying the rules of law to conflicts with non-Christians and advocated the separation of church and state. This man was von Pufendorf, and let's see if I can get this thing right here. Here we are. Hairy fellow. Another major event in history was the Somerset case in England in 1772, which made slavery illegal in the British Isles. And every time Parliament met, under consideration was whether or not to extend slavery to the colonies. The American Revolution, we think of tea parties. To the Southerners, actually, they were afraid that the abolition of slavery in the colonies was going to result in a great economic loss to them. Internationally, the slave trade at sea was abolished, about 1807. What that did, effectively, the British Navy enforced a sort of blockade. The American Navy, most of the ship's officers came from the South, and we were pretty half-hearted about doing it. But it did drive up the price of basically slaves. They became short of supply. Put it in perspective, on the docks of Baltimore, an illegal African immigrant could bring you $40,000 in currency, pretty significant. The result was not being easily replaced. The slavery issue became sort of pretty big, and particularly some of our universalist forebears operated the Underground Railway and some other things like that. Well, the Napoleonic Wars, we gained the Louisiana Territory, and Andrew Jackson, one of our $20 bill president, whose portrait currently has pride of place in the Oval Office, came down to Pensacola because too many of his valuable properties were trotting down here and living a good life. And so Pensacola had to become part of the United States, and some other people moved further down into Florida, merged with the Indian tribes, and the so Florida had to become part of the Union. That was done through the Seminole Wars, which made General Jackson pretty famous. In 1833, the British Parliament acted to free the slaves in the colonies. And long about that time, slavery under the Catholic Church, slaves were considered human beings, not so much property, and had certain rights. They had one day a week off, and they could buy their freedom if they could raise the money. So the South America, when they freed the slaves, and that included Mexico, a lot of American planters, Mr. Bowie and Houston and some others, were afraid they were going to lose their field hands. And so we had a Mexican War, which didn't go over really big in New England. And much of what I'm talking about actually has roots in New England. In New England, the heritage was from the Puritans. Puritans were a bunch of Calvinists who were driven out of England. They had taken over England at one point under Cromwell, and then they were a little overdid it, and the Royalists took the country back, and the Puritans came over here. And this was the blasphemy law under the colonies. After the Revolution, they sort of moderated it, and that was the law then. They got away with that job on the tongue. The Unitarians had a problem with this because they had to deal with Jesus Christ very gently. Now, William Channing was trained as a Unitarian minister at Harvard College, which became the divinity school for Unitarians. The He gave what is called the Baltimore Sermon. I actually printed it out. It's available in the library. It's not very interesting reading. It's sort of like the American Constitution, which a lot of people might claim they read, but we wonder if they really did. And the he had to go to Baltimore to do this at the time, and it established the principles of Unitarianism. And most of his quotation was basically from the Bible, which was the one accepted reference at the time. In substance, the Unitarians looked to logic and reason. They felt that their role in this world was to make themselves better, to improve themselves, wisdom. Science was just coming up at the time. Harvard did, I believe at the time, had a medical school. The medical teachings in particularly the Western was letting blood and carving corpses. It wasn't until a later date that a Dr. Semmelweis convinced the doctors to wash between corpses. And a lot more people stayed alive after that. Because there's logic, and if you do actually trouble yourself to read the Baltimore Sermon, it didn't exactly pack the house in the churches. It was kind of a sleepy time for everybody. I hope I'm not replicating that today. The famous fellow by the name of Emerson was ordained as a Unitarian minister, and he was found a little frustrating playing to a rather, a couple seats up front, and that was it, and decided to spice things up. Out of the Napoleonic Wars, and a lot of French philosophers, I think they sort of disappeared. The French Revolution shocked the Americans because they felt they overdone it. The idea of equality was anyone was not equal. You equalize them by cutting their heads off. Well, probably today's sort of a social solution, it might gain some acceptance. The idea that Emerson had was to get a spiritual attribute, and he got into transcendentalism, and that really is a whole separate subject. I don't want to get in too deeply with it today. Most of my sources actually find it rather comical, but it all starts, you have to believe that nothing exists, this is all figment of your own imagination, and once you believe that, then away we go. Well, the one thing that came out of the transcendental thing, it was kind of, you all get together and argue, and endless arguments, because you can never compromise. Women would start holding discussion groups. They were not allowed to go to college or even much schooling, but they were digging into Greek philosophers, and this was pretty raunchy stuff, because you got into Greek philosophers, you start getting women goddesses, women emperors, women warriors, women generals, and bad stuff like that to know. But that pretty much carried on, I'll give you Ralph there. For some reason, my PowerPoint cuts off heads. It's something to do with the French Revolution, I guess. And I said in 1938 was the last conviction for blasphemy. The Unitarians were, I'll just stay with them for another moment. Science was coming up, and Harvard got very much into science, and in the later 1840s, a very prominent scientist by the name of Agassiz became the chair of the science department at Harvard. And when I was taking geology, we studied a lot of stuff from Agassiz. The only thing about Agassiz was he absolutely hated Negroes and spent a lot of time trying to prove their inferiority. You went to Harvard, you kind of... Well, in this time, there was no divinity school for universalists. You became a Unitarian minister, but many of them actually were of a universalist leaning. This brings me to a fellow I think isn't talked about enough, Theodore Parker. Farm boy, never had much money, had a great mind, smart enough that the Harvard professors allowed him to sit in on the courses, but he was not enrolled. But by some way, he could take the final examinations and graduated with a degree as a Unitarian minister from Harvard. He taught in the sort of the slum churches around Boston, and basically adhered to the universalist concept, where we had Channing was logic over zeal, and the universalists believed that before God, all men were equal. And that fit a little more into the American ideal, and it was playing to different class of people, particularly the Boston snobs. Brahmins, I believe they call most of them. In 1841, with that blasphemy thing off, Parker gave a sermon at one of the churches in Massachusetts. It was an ordination sermon. He gave it the best then. His thesis was that ideas are eternal and have their own existence, and that the principles of Christianity, of kindness and loving your neighbor and things like that, could exist without the existence of Jesus Christ. Ordination ceremony, the ministers from churches were invited. Unfortunately, ministers from Trinitarian churches were invited. All hell broke loose. Well, sold a lot of newspapers for quite a while, and firmly establishes Theodore Parker as a transcendentalist. I don't think he meant to do that at all. He took it as far as logic would take it, and from then on, he actually became a universalist in all practice. Now, what was happening with the Universalists was the Industrial Revolution. We had the Universalist ministers usually were, their degree was as a Unitarian, because it wasn't until 1852 when they had a seminary college of their own. The Universalist belief was that the intention of God was for them, people generally, to give their lives to make this a better world. And what was happening was corporations, instead of your local owner, unknown people owned the business and wanted money out of it. Natural human instinct to exploit each other. Slavery is one form. Because the Industrial Revolution was a demand for coal, and coal lies deep in the ground. And it takes men to go in and get it, or didn't at that time. Now we just take the whole mountain. The coal miners, common people, not the preordained, they worked 12 hours in the mine, and they were paid by how much coal they brought out. It took them about an hour to get into the mine, another hour to get out, so you're looking at about a 14-hour day, two shifts. The Universalists and some others thought this was kind of unfair, and they were doing some labor organizing. Coal mine owners figured out this neat way to make sure the shifts overlapped church time so nobody could get to hear all that seditious stuff about everybody being equal and stuff like that. Mill workers, weaving. Weaving had been a cottage industry, and then they invented looms and spinning machines. And cotton was a bad thing. It was not easy to make into good thread. But with the spinning machines, they could make good thread out of cotton, and the demand for cotton went way up. The demand for the southern crops went way up. The need for more slaves to work the fields went way up. In New England, where they had water power for the mills, one thing that came out was sort of assembly line stuff. The work was easy. It didn't require the skilled labor that it had before you had the machine. And so what do we have? You know those little brats you got running around? Put them to work. And so child labor became... You work a kid on a farm, what do? They feed chickens and stuff like that. But you put to work in a mill, you know, get white lung, the other guy's got black lung. And the other thing was, of course, sailors. And so actually a lot of sailors were universalists. All these people were still under some of the Puritan concept. They were all going to go to hell. But if you hung out with the universalists, maybe you had a chance, you know. Just to make one thing about sailors in the triangle trade, if you know what that is, that was from the southern ports to England with cotton, from England to Africa with guns and knives and stuff like that, and from Africa to southern ports with illegal African immigrants. Ships were hell ships. Sailors did not want to be on those. That was the use of press gangs, boarding houses, all sorts of devices to get them on board. Statistically, of the slaves brought from Africa, the ones that didn't make it, died. 10% of the slaves on the ships died. And that was a loss of $40,000 for each one. The sailors, the loss of life was 15%. Now, a sailor dies at sea, no back wages. You had a freebie. Why keep them alive? Universalists had a whole lot of good stuff to sell here to and a market, but no money in it, but at least you could, whatever borrowed meeting hall you had, you could fill it. And so that was the two directions of the church. In 1850, our legislature passed the Fugitive Slave Act, and after that, everything became abolitionist, and the labor unions and stuff like that just didn't crop again, up again for another 50 years or more. But the yeah, we did fight the revolution, and we got rid of slavery, but we'll never get rid of racism. So there's work to be done. And now we're all together. We've got science on our side and kind hearts. So I thank you for this time.
Thank you, Rob.
You're welcome.
Our closing words today are from Duke T. Gray. The blessing of truth be upon us. The power of love direct us and sustain us. And may the peace of this community preserve our going out and our coming in from this time forth until we meet again. Go in peace.